Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
My first royalty check was $3,400. The second one was $8,400. The third one was $34,000. The fourth one was $84,000. And that was per month. It grew up to $125,000 per week. I mean, it was just incredible. So being $100,000 in debt, I put a goal in my mind. I need to get that $100,000 back. And I was earning well over $100,000 per week. Ultimately, it became the number one product in the world.
Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable audio business interviews. Internet marketing and marketing in general can be a minefield. Thousands of people every day lose their shirts trying. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Hi there, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. I've got a 3-hour interview with a guy who sold over $400 million worth of exercise equipment. This is an amazing journey, an amazing interview. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. I'm pleased to introduce to you John Abdo. John Abdo is regarded around the world as an authority on motivation, health, fitness, and athletic conditioning. He was a former Olympic trainer. He's trained numerous Olympic and world-class athletes, including speed skater Bonnie Blair. She was a multiple gold medal recipient. He was recently introduced into the National Fitness Hall of Fame from 1985 to 1997. John produced and hosted his own weekly syndicated television series called Training and Nutrition, where he interviewed geniuses and all the authorities on health and nutrition. He had an audience reaching over 50 million households. He established himself as one of the most visible motivational educators for legions of athletes, fitness enthusiasts, coaches nationwide. Many of John's programming and commercial advertising techniques were his own self-created marketing creations, and they form many branches in DRTV and educational programming. Today, John has over 3 million people in 120 countries using his products, training systems, or adhering to his motivational principles. He's a highly in-demand editorial consultant. He makes regular contributions for popular magazines like Men's Health, Details, Outside, Women's World, and even Muscle and Fitness. This is one of the most dedicated guys I've ever met to helping other inventors. He conducts seminars to educate and motivate inventors on both what to do and what not to do. In 1999, John was nearly bankrupt and about $100,000 in debt. By the end of 2001, John's products and services had generated nearly $400 million. If you watch television infomercials, you may even be familiar with his product called the Abdoer. With nearly $75 million in media expenditure, his invention was voted number one product in 2001. It was outselling all the other top four products combined in his category. John has also been the recipient of the Best Fitness Presenter Award by the Electronic Retailing Association for generating the most revenue from his live and pre-recorded television appearances. On Live Shopping Channel alone, John has generated over $30 million in sales. sales and scored the single-day record of $2.5 million in sales. John's latest inventions include the bun and thigh doer, contour weights, waist-to-waist conditioning system, and many more. What makes John so unique and valuable is that he's not only the product inventor, he's also the product's on-air spokesperson. He's the program developer. He's the strategic marketer, and much, much more. In the next 3 hours, you're going to hear in detail about how John got started, his humble beginnings, his challenges on the way to ultimate success. You're going to hear John reveal secrets that he's never revealed before about the insides of the television infomercial industry. You're going to gain knowledge and access to John's contacts through a unique conglomeration of contacts that he's built over the years, and he's going to show you how to use his contacts to give you a better chance in developing and creating and marketing your own invention through television. Get ready. Let's get going.
Without inventors, you wouldn't be sitting on the chair that you're sitting on. I wouldn't be talking on the phone I'm talking on. I wouldn't be able to do my morning business. I wouldn't be able to do anything without inventors. Everything that you could see right now and for the rest of your day is a thought turned into a thing. We need inventors. We need the ideas. The thing is, the idea people aren't the marketing people most of the time. So I have always seen and shared a commonality with all inventors. We don't know who to trust. We don't know where to go. We've been ripped off before. We don't know if we're going to get paid on all our units. We don't know if we're making the right decision. It's fear, 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 fear. So I'm here to protect inventors. I'm here to tell inventors I love them. They're my brothers and sisters, and I'm encouraging them because I thrive as well as everyone thrives on innovation. Without inventors, the world would not be as fast, as safe, as productive, as happy as it could be, as it should be. Inventors is what makes the world tick.
That is so true. I mean, I'm sitting here in front of my computer. I'm looking at my computer. I'm looking at my lamp. I'm looking at a flashlight, a pair of scissors, my video camera, this label writer, label machine, my calculator, my stapler, scotch tape, and a pen. And all of these things are inventions. And I think it's really important for the listeners here to get an idea where you came from and how this all started, because all your learning was based on your journey from the humble beginnings and the struggles and all the way through. So if the listeners will bear with us and listen to your story from the beginning, I think it's really going to benefit them to see how you got there. And we're going to talk about this alliance that you've set up in detail towards the end of the interview. But let's take the listener on a journey. Let's start from the beginning. Is that okay?
Yes.
What sport were you training in for your Olympics?
My specific sport was Olympic weightlifting. And Olympic weightlifting is not a very popular American sport, but it's a fascinating sport. A lot of people describe it as doing gymnastics with weights. The lifts are called the snatch and the clean and jerk, and you're actually flipping weights up overhead. And it takes a lot of technical skill, not just strength. There's a lot of strong guys that lose to the technical guys. So it took strength, it took skill, a lot of training, a lot of precision. But the thing I loved about it, in addition to the specific weight training techniques for Olympic weightlifting, and there's two other sports, bodybuilding, which you pose and you just show off your body. That's not an Olympic sport, and that's very popular, but it's more cosmetic. And powerlifting. Powerlifting is the bench press, the squat, and the deadlift. That's not an Olympic sport. Even though it does require a lot of technique, it's mostly known for its brute strength. Olympic weightlifting is an Olympic sport, and being an aspiring Olympic athlete, it exposed me to athletes and coaches and training principals around the world. And it was just fantastic because the techniques with that allowed me to do what we call remedial or adjunct training, which took you outside of the weight training environment where we did plyometrics, we did field strength training, running bleachers, jumping, all types of flexibility exercises. On our days of rest, we had what we call active rest. We played basketball or volleyball or things like that. So as athletes, we were constantly active. And then when I decided to start coaching other athletes outside my specific sport, the great thing about it, I started learning that, again, a 9-year-old female figure skater was benefiting from these techniques because they're techniques that anybody could use, so you don't have to specifically compete at the sport I was competing in. For instance, if I played football and I taught football techniques, those techniques may only be good for football players, but they may not be good for female figure skaters. The weightlifting techniques, along with other strength training, injury prevention, injury rehabilitation techniques, which I also studied and applied, again, Michael, were advantageous for all kinds of athletes.
John, tell me more about the television show that you had produced. TV Guide magazine ranked that as one of the number one shows at that time?
It was ranked the number one educationally based fitness show. Other fitness shows are watch them participate, you turn it on and you do your aerobic dance to the guy or the gal or the team that was teaching it. Or other fitness shows were behind certain competitions, like, hey, let's go and watch the competitors compete. My show was a sit down, listen and learn. This was behind the scenes, what the coaches, the trainers, the athletes, the therapists did in the training center before, during, and after competition to prepare for and recover the athlete from their competition. So it was highly educational. Myself, being a former Olympic athlete, which this underdeveloped kid turned into an Olympic athlete, I lived in training centers. I was an athlete, but I always coupled up as an athlete coach. I always coached as I was competing. I just had a knack for it. I had a desire for it. I was good at it. And, you know, I couldn't hold back. Hey, if I know something, I'm going to want to share it with other people, especially my fellow athletes. So one thing led to another to where I started strength coaching athletes, and the beautiful thing about the strength training and sports enhancement training techniques that I was learning over the years, it was applicable to all athletes. I could train big, strong, heavy, professional football players, but at the same time, in the same training center, I was working with 9-year-old female figure skaters. And so I was able to learn and apply successfully the techniques that were advantageous to the improvement of any type of athlete, no matter what sport they were in, at any age level and level of ability. They were healthy to make them even better. They were injured to help them recover from injury. And I worked in conjunction with physical therapists and orthopedic surgeons because I'm not a doctor. So we worked well as a team.
Tell me the years the show ran and tell me some of the big names that the listeners would recognize of some of the athletes that you interviewed during those years.
The show started in 1985, and I remember producing my first show, which preceded me being a guest on shows. And being a guest, it's like what you're doing right now. You ask me a question and I answer it. You know, I don't have notes here. It's like I know my business, I know my life, and I'm able to answer it. But one day, the host of the show calls me up on the phone, and we became friendly over time, and he says, John, I'm quitting the show. I want to go back to school. And I thought, there is the end of my television career, Michael. You know, and I had aspired to be on TV to teach the masses health and fitness and strength training and all this other stuff. But the studio director and some of the other producers of the show, this was just a local cable show in the Chicagoland area, says, John, you got to continue on with the show. And I told him, I don't have any understanding of how to produce a TV show. This is back in 1985. And they says, John, you've gotten really good in front of the camera. Our audience is liking you. We're getting letters. Let's turn your little segment, which I just had like 10 to 15 minutes of a half-hour show, into a full half-hour show with John Abdo. So October 21st, 1985, I remember it specifically, I produced my first TV show, and that show ran for 12 and a half years from that point forward. I think I had like a two-week hiatus because that was back in the days when cable was just starting and on TV and the sports channels and the prime networks. And my two-week hiatus was one of the big networks bought another network. I think Prime bought the sports channel, and they had to turn down their transponders, which supplied their feeds just to sync up their whole system. So technically, I was on the air straight for 12 and a half years, and it was just fantastic. The guests I've had on my show, Corey Everson, all-time female decorated bodybuilder, the Olympic athletes that I've had, like the teams, the Bonnie Blairs of the world. I did features with the Chicago Bulls because I was in Chicago at the time, Chicago Bears, Chicago Blackhawks, Lou Ferrigno. The list goes on and on and on. I mean, it was really wonderful. And for me, it's almost like the position that you're in. You get to interview all these great people. I've been to your website. It's like, wow, Michael's got a great list of people that he's been able to interview. Myself, being so interested in this whole world of strength training and sports enhancement and ultimate physical peak performance, now I was able to interview all these people, and they were sharing their secrets with me. And obviously, there's so much you could edit into a half-hour show, and I didn't just interview them for a half hour. We would do interviews much longer than that and edit it down to a half hour. So it made me so much more educated and so much more of a better coach by the exposure and the experience that I've had from tapping into these other sources.
It's a great advantage. I mean, you've already done for all those years what I've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years, just in a different field, marketing and copywriting and advertising. And it's great because you're never wasting time. You are training. You're picking the minds of some of the best in the world. And I'm doing the same thing. It's a great use of your time, even in the production aspect of it. When you're editing, you're always learning because you have to listen to some of these things 2 and 3 and 4 times, and you can still pull out valuable information.
Well, you know, that's exactly true, Michael. I mean, that's an interesting observation. It probably can only come from somebody with your type of experience or career path because, you know, a lot of times when you hear somebody say something, especially if they say it for the first time, you know, a lot of people may be naysayers or, yeah, right, or I'll believe it when I really see it, meaning that the techniques and the advice that people are giving is like, I'll believe it when I see it, that if people pursue the principles of that method, that they're waiting to see the actual manifestations of the results or the goals. And when you're working with Olympic athletes and professional athletes, I mean, these people are at the top of their game. I mean, the top on the globe and the whole planet Earth. These are people who say that if you follow these principles, you will reach success. I instantaneously had faith and belief and confidence in them. But what the barrier was back then, and the reason why I had a very large, dedicated athletic viewership, people who were very interested in self-help and improvement and were willing to apply the principles, was the fact that these were new principles. Unlike if you go to a newsstand right now and you pick up one of those magazines with the Muscle Men on the cover, those magazines are just telling you how to make your body bigger and more symmetrical, which is great, but it wasn't geared towards athletic performance. And most, if not all, of those magazines are secretly hidden, even though right now it's been pretty blatant that they're selling supplements. So here's this guy with all these muscles, and he's got two gorgeous women hanging off his biceps and his neck, and it's like, hey, if you use this supplement, you're going to look like this, and you're going to be attractive in other areas of your life. And when I read these magazines, I see how they're misdirecting the audience. It's really not the way things are going. And obviously, there's a lot of these athletes, and I say a lot, a high percentage of them, that are using anabolic steroids, and they're promoting natural supplements that you can buy over the counter, whether it's a protein tablet or a powder or some kind of a mixed drink, and they're promoting that you can get like that, to look like that, with that supplement, and it's simply not true. So on my show, I talked about the good, the bad, and the ugly, because there are ugly sides to sports. I mean, there's a lot of drugs involved in sports. There's a lot of illegal tactics involved in sports. It's competitive, and a lot of people's lives, the coaches and the athletes, thrive on it, and a lot of careers are made as a result of them reaching a certain level or accomplishment, like winning a gold medal at the Olympic Games. So it's the do-or-die type of attitude.
Did you place in the Olympics? What year Olympics were you at? Where were they held?
I competed in the Olympic trials in 1976, and unfortunately I had a knee injury. You know, I look back now, and not just now, but shortly thereafter, and that was like the turning point in my career, where I loved the sport so much, and I says, hey, I'm just concentrating on this guy called John Abdo. I'm working just for myself, and even though I have a team, in Olympic weightlifting, it's an individual sport. You compete as a team, but you're not out there with a bunch of other teammates. And what I decided to do after I got injured at the Olympic trials in 76, and before that I had won a national championships, I had competed internationally 4 times, I won numerous state championships and regional championships, so I was definitely climbing the ladder. But when I took the focus off, Michael, was me, and I went to my we attitude, and that's been my motto, you know. It's not about me, it's about we. So I started coaching other athletes, and I found it so much fun because I was still training, but the competitive drive and the pressure that it put on my body, my bones, my hormones, my recuperative system were taken off, and I was able to work with a group of athletes, which when I went to a competition, all of a sudden I was in charge of a lot of athletes, and I found it far more enlightening for myself to be a coach than an actual athlete. But I had to obviously precede coaching with being an athlete myself because it taught me what you need to do as far as disciplining yourself to the principles of applying the results producing phases of just enduring the process. So, you know, sports taught me a lot. Sports taught me how to stick to principle, how to stay committed to principle, how when you get knocked off of principle and people fall off track, how to get yourself right back on track. If you get injured, how to get uninjured and how to recuperate. It was just fantastic. And I use that today in my business. I use it in my motivational speaking. I do a lot of consulting. I'm not just working with athletes anymore. I'm working with inventors and business people and entrepreneurs and all types of people that are seeking self-betterment, and these principles apply to everybody. For instance, people say, well, how could Olympic athletes' principles apply to me? I'm just a housewife. Well, if you follow a certain principle, even though it may not be an athletic principle, and you adhere to that principle, not just physically, but emotionally and intellectually and spiritually, you will manifest great results, and that's what people don't understand and or have the ability to stay committed to because they don't have a coach, they don't have a mentor. So when they have a coach or a mentor, and I've seen so many athletes who train on their own and were always getting injured. And then as soon as they came into the gym and they said, hey, John, can you and your assistant coaches train me? All of a sudden, they never got injured after that, and they recovered from their previous injuries. They were probably training harder than they ever trained before, so it doesn't make sense. If they're training harder, how come they're not getting injured? They're training smarter and wiser, and they had a specific set of principles that they adhered to that allowed them to make that point A to point B tap straight as opposed to wiggling and squiggling, which so many people experience going through life. Everyone is shooting towards a destination. Unfortunately, they're always veering off track.
Let me ask you this for kicks. What was your personal best on the clean and jerk overhead?
My personal best on the clean and jerk was 352 pounds, did a snatch of 281 pounds, and I competed in two weight classes. I competed at 165, which I'm at my playing weight right now at 52 years of age. I actually look the same, so I've been able to keep these principles active in my life to at least look the same and actually feel a lot better because it's a lot easier to stay healthy when you take a lot of pressure off your body. But as far as getting strong, it was just such an interesting phenomenon and such an ego boost, if you want to call it that, but certainly a confidence boost. When you're able to accomplish something, like I remember as a kid, there's no way I'm ever going to lift 300 pounds over my head, or it was a goal where it's like, oh man, I would love to lift 300 pounds over my head. And then I remember one day I was doing it for repetitions, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, I remember years ago when I had set this goal, and every day, Michael, that goal never left my mind and never left my heart. It doesn't even leave your cellular physiology. It vibrates in your body. When you set a goal and you're determined to achieve it, you achieve it. It's just that some people, what I have found, people that come to me, oh, I got to lose weight. Oh, I got to go on a diet. Oh, I got to do this. You know, I ask people the first thing, because being a coach, I want to know, number one, how committed are you? Because if you're just a little bit committed, then I'll give you just a little bit committed program that's going to give you little types of results. But if you're really committed, I'll give you a really committed program that's going to deliver real results, but it's up to you. Being the coach and the instructor and the motivator, a lot of people think that I'm the miracle worker. I'm not. I'm the one who designs the map, but they're the ones who are driving the course themselves. So it's really what's in your heart. And I ask people, do you really want this? And they go, yeah, I really want this. I go, okay, let me ask you this again. Do you really, really want this? And then there's times when I go, do you really, 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 really want this? Because, you know, when people are driven towards a goal, they really, really, really want it. They don't just really want it. And the more you say the word really, the more it goes deeper inside your body, because it's not just what's between your ears, your brain, or what's beating in the center of your chest, your heart. It's every single cell in your body contains an intelligence that is thriving off of the energy that you're feeding it that will allow you to attain your goals.
Were you ever offered or tempted to take anabolic steroids in your training in like Olympic competitions or as an athlete?
Yes, actually I did take anabolic steroids for a year, and I was very young, and this was another reason why I decided to retire myself, because I didn't want to pursue it. I'm glad I experienced it. I'm fortunate enough to not have had the negative side effects that some people have had. But, you know, I believe that when you experience something, you're able to teach it better. And I actually experienced the underground anabolic world in sports, and it's amazing, Michael. I mean, these drugs are powerful drugs. They do work. There are so many kinds of drugs out there that do different types of things, from making you run faster to making you more muscular to making you stronger to making you recuperate 10 times faster. That's why these athletes can go into the gym and train 6 hours today, literally, because they'll have like 2-3 hour sessions. And then the next day, they're doing the same thing. It's like, wait a minute, you know, if I train 6 hours, hey, I'm going to need 2 or 3 days or a week, and some people a month to recover. So they're recovering agents and things like that. But yeah, I got myself involved in that only, it wasn't out of passion. It was given to me by coaches, and I won't mention any names or anything like that, but the coaches then knew it was illegal, it wasn't right, but it wasn't as bad as it is today because anabolic steroids are a controlled substance classified in the area of narcotics, and it's illegal to administer and sell them. So now I do a lot of coaching and consulting and even guest speaking for schools and organizations on drug cessation, not just on anabolic steroids, but all types of drugs. And what I have found since I have taken anabolic steroids, which I just mentioned a little while ago, I look the same and I actually feel better today at 52 than what I did when I was 25 because I'm following healthy principles, not the quick way of, hey, let's take this drug and let's see how it's going to improve my athletic performance.
Well, anyone who goes to your website, johnabdo.com, I mean, there's some pictures of you and you are ripped. Are you still ripped like that right now?
I'm ripped like that right now. As you know, I invent exercise equipment and training programs. I'm on live TV all the time. I'll be on QVC TV later this month. And it's kind of interesting because a lot of times I go there with a t-shirt on, you know, looking fit. I got a tight t-shirt on so you can see, you know, I got a good symmetry and stuff like that. But the producers of the show, they go, John, you got to take your shirt off and show the audience. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, okay. So, no, I stay ripped, Michael, only because I follow the principles. I eat very good. I exercise very smart. And I think it. I think that I want to be healthy. I think that I want to be lean. I think that I want my body strong. And as a result of me thinking it, the body just develops automatically.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. I wanted the listeners to learn a little bit more about you and your history, and I want the focus of this interview to be on your story and how you are now kind of in a different point in your business career, going from an athlete and a trainer and a coach within the sports industry to a businessman, an inventor, and a serious player in the infomercial business. So I want to kind of move into that. First of all, did you have any kind of formal education?
No. Sometimes people say, well, what's your educational background, John? Well, my TV show, which I've produced 600 episodes, and I interviewed the best of the best, the coaches, the trainers, the doctors, the sports scientists from around the world, professional Olympic athletes and the like, that was my institution, Michael. I mean, I went to school, yes, I studied chiropractic, I studied physical therapy, I studied nutrition, I studied human biology and physiology and anatomy. So, yeah, I'm a master student of all the physical arts, but also the spiritual arts. What does it take to think properly and to use the unseen source to develop the seen things in our lives as well as the intellectual? So, you know, early in my career, I found out that whether I was teaching an athlete, like, hey, I want you to jump this way, or a person who needed to cut fat off their abdominals, I want you to twist your torso or your abdomen this way. What I found is that they needed the mental, intellectual, and spiritual stimulus to allow their bodies to move in a way that would produce the best results. For instance, a lot of people go into the gym and you could see two people doing exactly the same exercise, same form, everything like that. But if you look inside their brain, one person has a have-to attitude. I have to be here. The doctor told me I have to lose weight. I've got to get my body in shape. Blah, 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 blah. You know, they have a have-to attitude. But they look the same as the other guy who has a want-to attitude. This guy is there. I want to get better. I want to always improve. I love being here. This is good for my body. It's good for me. It's good for my family. It's good for the people around me. So now I've flipped things around where I teach motivation first. It's mind over matter, and your body's the matter. And as a result of that, I've become so much more successful in my eyes and obviously in my business because I'm literally standing on top of the world right now. I've been voted number one fitness spokesperson in the world several times. I've had the number one fitness products on TV. And it's not because I'm just selling product. People are using the products and benefiting from the products. So what I have is a huge platform via TV and now the Internet to introduce people who have never exercised before, who have abandoned exercise for a long period of time, to say, hey, I'm John Abdo. Let's start working out together, and here's the way to do it. And those of you who are already working out, but there's a lot of great-looking and successful people out there, which they all have a quality, including myself. We're never content. We could always get better. I can help people break past thresholds or plateaus or sticking points and things like that. So I've been able to diversify myself, Michael, to where my career is dedicated to helping other people improve themselves. And the one beautiful thing I found out, and I mentioned earlier, it's not about me, it's about we, When you give to other people, you at the same time are giving to yourself. And the other thing that I found turning from athlete to coach is that when I started coaching people and started telling people what to do and teaching people and instructing people, I would go home at night saying, I'm a smarter person. You learn from coaching. You learn from teaching. So I'm always telling people to teach and mentor and coach and discipline themselves while at the same time sharing that same advice with other people. So it's a cycle of give and you receive, and it's a wonderful principle to apply.
All right, so you may have already said it, but so what's John Abdo's mission and purpose?
My mission and purpose is to help people become better. I believe because of my directive in seeking self-betterment spiritually, intellectually, emotionally, and physically, that I've been able to realize and will continue to realize, I have the confidence to know that I will always improve because these are universal principles that yield success. There's a lot of people out there who may be, and you may know, a lot of people who are very spiritual, but they got no money. Or there's a lot of people out there who do have a lot of money, but they got poor health and they're out of shape. I try to balance people's lives where everything works, and the goals that they say that they have, I want to make money, I want to lose weight. You know, do you really, really, really want this? Because if you do, here's some principles for you to achieve that. So John Abdo is a life motivator. I've turned from an athlete to an Olympic and a professional coach to a life motivator. By applying certain principles, you adapt to these principles, and the end result is sheer success and accomplishment.
Well, it sounds like you're at the top right now, but things haven't always been so easy for you. In 1999, you nearly went bankrupt. After your show ended, where were your first efforts in marketing and selling products? And tell me a little bit about what happened with the near bankruptcy in 1999, some of your low points.
As I mentioned, I had a TV show for 12 years, from 1985 to 1997. And in 1995, 1996, you know, television advertisers just started weaning out, and it was tough. I produced the show. I was a host of the show. I syndicated the show. I mean, I wore all the hats. The only thing I didn't do is I wasn't a cameraman, and I didn't do the editing.
Let me ask this. How big of a reach did that show get up to?
50 million households, and it started at like 12,000.
So you were syndicating nationally?
I was syndicating internationally. It was up on Transponder, which throws it up on satellite dish. So I was getting calls from the United Kingdom. I was getting calls from Canada. I was getting calls from the Virgin Islands. But most of the straight line distribution was here in the United States. And I had a very large and dedicated viewership. But I sold commercial time on the show to like Muscle and Fitness magazine and General Nutrition Centers and companies like that, because not only were they in the commercial time of the show, but the packages that I sold them, and I became a marketing expert at this, Michael. I never went to school for it. They said, hey, if they're going to be in the commercial, let me put them in the body of the show. Muscle and Fitness has got athletes, they got doctors and writers, and they got nutritional products. So now I was able to bring their expert resources into the body of the show. And when it was in the body of the show, it wasn't a commercial. We were talking specifically to principles of success and nutrition and health and sports performance. And at the same time, I sold them what I called a splash advertising package, where they got a billboard on the show and commercial time on the show.
So this show was the foundation. You didn't know it, but the years of experience in operating the show and producing the show and selling advertising and doing marketing with your advertisers, this is all foundational for what you've been doing recently, right?
You know, when I was given the opportunity to produce my own TV show, which preceded me just being a guest of the show, I didn't know how to produce a show. But I had other people producing it at the time for me, the cameramen, the studios, they had the distribution, the syndication, things like that, albeit it was like 12,000 households. But as I wanted to grow the show and bring it into other homes and networks across the country, I needed funding. I just couldn't do it on my shoestring budget as I was doing in the past, and or relying on the studio who produced it with their funding dollars. So I had to assume other roles and responsibilities. I started selling sponsorships for the show, and I got creative with the sponsorships of the show. I would wear T-shirts of the companies that were sponsoring the show. I would have their guests, like Muscle and Fitness magazine. Lou Ferrigno was on the cover of Muscle and Fitness magazine, so I had Lou Ferrigno come on the show, and we'd talk about the Incredible Hulk and his bodybuilding career and when he competed against Arnold and things like that. But also Muscle and Fitness had a commercial in the show. So I became entrepreneurial in the fact that I was learning as I was going, but because my business and my life and my sustenance thrived on it, I learned very quick. So now as an inventor, I'm able to put together packages that not only supply the product, but the marketing behind the product, which is so essential in a product's success in the marketplace, whether it's on TV, at retail, on internet, because there's a lot more than meets the eye, and that is part of the value of me as a consultant or as a teacher of other inventors and business owners and entrepreneurs, because there's more to that than what meets the eye. And the example I give the Barbie doll analogy. You know, Barbie doll is just a Barbie doll. But what made Barbie doll so successful was all the clothes and the jewelry and the little purses and the little shoes that these little kids were able to buy after they bought the Barbie doll and put it on. And then what did they come up with? They came up with Kent. And then they came up with the little Corvette. So now all of a sudden, you know, most kids just buy one Barbie doll, and if you were in the Barbie doll business, after you've exhausted that audience, now all of a sudden you have to go find another business. But because of the aftermarket add-on accessories, it made that a multi-billion dollar business, and that's what I do with a lot of companies that I work with. It's like, hey, let's think about what your main product is, and let's talk about the aftermarket, and let's see how we can integrate it in between. That's just one of the many principles that allows people to become successful in direct marketing.
Now, when you were doing your TV show and you were selling sponsorships, say, to GNC and Muscle and Fitness, I'm sure your eyes opened. You saw that these guys were making big money with what they were doing, you know, selling, I guess, nutritional and weight loss products. Did this influence you through your experience seeing what some of your sponsors were doing and how they were doing it? And was that some of the driving force that got you into developing and marketing and selling your own products?
Absolutely. It's the energy that you put yourself in that influences you. So as a personal trainer at the time making $27,000 a year and meeting Joe Weider, who was making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, I said, hey, I got something that I know can benefit them, and they have something I know could benefit me. It's a win-win proposition, and at the same time, I and my company and the people involved with my company, I want to levitate them to higher levels of accomplishment, albeit a higher income, as well as all the other residual opportunities and benefits. So I was awe-inspired by the people who had started their careers before me but had developed them into multi-million dollar operations. So I fed off their energy, but at the same time, I knew I had the same type of energy. I just had not matured to that level yet, but I was climbing the ladder, and they seen in me my drive, my determination, my passion and ambition, which is very important attributes that impresses people who are going to get involved with you. And at the same time, again, it was a win-win scenario. It wasn't like, hey, give me money. I need the money to support my show. It was more like, I have a show that I know can benefit you. And when you show people that, even if they say it or not, they what's in it for me type of proposal, it's like, hey, you know, this is going to benefit me and my company. And what I found, Michael, is that these companies, it's not just Joe Weider. Joe Weider's got thousands of people working for him. His company is his family. So when you help another person's company, you're helping the families that work for those companies and the children and everything else. The economic impact of great business is phenomenal, and that's the driving force that I have in building my business, because I have thousands of people working for me right now, and as a result of the economic impact of my business, you're not just helping me pay my rent and put food on my table and take care of my immediate family. When my business succeeds, thousands of people are being benefited from it. So it's a responsibility, and the responsibility factor is something that really is a great driving force.
Who were some of your real business mentors? Like, was Joe Weider a business mentor to you? Did you have any giants in the industry that you really looked up to and kind of took you under their wing and directed you, or did you do it all on your own?
You know, I would say I did it all on my own, and something I probably am regretting now, only because there was a part of me back then, not now, there was a part of me back then that did not want me to disclose to people that, hey, I'm only making $27,000 a year and you guys are making hundreds of millions a year. I didn't want to show that. And when I went to these companies, because I was going to them for the intent of securing funding and sponsorship in a win-win scenario, I was thinking and acting literally and even believing that I was on their level. And as a result of it, it manifested. But in all honesty, Michael, I did feed off their energy, and I did watch the way that they handled me and the situation, the decisions that they made, their diplomacy, the way they articulated things, how they paid and sent me the checks when the checks were due, things like that. And I said, hey, you know, successful people are honorable people, so I definitely learned from that. But outside of that, my mentors have been people like Napoleon Hill and U.S. Anderson and James Allen and all these great people that have written all these great books over the years, you know, avatars like Jesus Christ and all these people who have done great miraculous things by following the principles. So I delved into books, into audio cassette tapes and things like that. In my time that I wasn't presenting myself to other people, I was feeding off of the energy of the past that is ongoing. So I would say that that was my mentorship pursuit.
All right, what happened in 1999? You were near bankruptcy. Where were you at that point of your career?
First off, let me tell everybody that struggle is probably the best thing that anybody can experience. And, you know, we started this conversation out talking about athletes and how athletes train and they have to work real hard and they succumb to very rigorous training principles, hours and hours a day and things like that. But the end result is a highly conditioned organism, albeit the human organism. Without the struggle, the pain or the challenge, there's no way somebody can condition themselves up.
It's a mental training, that's all.
Yeah, it's a mental training, and it's scratching for the truth. And in my time of financial turmoil, sponsors were pulling out of my show because it was actually after 8 to 10 years, you know, my show being a unique show, there's a lot of copycat shows out there. There were dozens of aerobic shows and fitness shows. So a lot of these main sponsors considered, hey, they had the same audience as John Abdo or a similar audience. Let's buy time on their show. So what I was commanding is like $2,500 for a 30-second commercial. It dwindled down to like $250. I mean, the show was poor. It wasn't making any money. So I was near bankruptcy. I was very close to or right at $100,000 in debt. Had a beautiful three-bedroom home on a river in upstate Illinois. Had a boat in the water and a dock that I had in my backyard, so the boat was always in the water.
Were you married at the time?
I was not married at the time.
How about now?
I'm not married now. I'm a single guy. I was married once. I have a beautiful daughter who is 26 years old. She was born on my birthday. So I've gone through the typical adversarial situations like most people go through, certainly a lot of entrepreneurs. But, you know, when I experienced the near bankruptcy, I sold everything that I owned. I had to liquidate. Had enough money to pay off some debts, which bought me some time. Michael, I had 6 months to live, literally. I moved out to California. I figured if I'm going to be homeless, I'm going to go where it's warm. I'm going to go where it's warm.
There you go.
So I went out to California, and because of the TV show that I had produced up to about 2 years before that, there is a hotel that I used to credit on the show, accommodations provided by. It was in Venice, California. They were very sweet. They said, if you ever come out to California, we'll put you up. And I don't know how long they put me up, but they put me up for 3 months. It was 6 months to the day that I started earning royalties for my first invention. It was one of those things where I only had 6 months, and it was 6 months to the day that I earned my first royalty check. And from that point, it was just unbelievable. I became a millionaire within 5 months of that point, completely turned my life around, and all I do is look back and say those principles that I followed and committed to with a want-to attitude, not a have-to attitude, finally came to fruition in spite of all this adversarial situation. I sold my big three-bedroom, beautiful home, my boat, my cars. I sold everything. All that was, the way I look at it, a test by the universe of my faith and patience, but to show that there was a big change in my life, and that big change included changing everything, including my residency, my location, and everything like that.
Okay, so you stayed in this hotel. Where was the hotel?
Venice, California, right on the beach in Venice.
Oh, perfect. So you're right on the beach in Venice, and they put you up for 3 months. And so when you first came out, what was this idea? What was this invention? Tell me where this idea started.
I had been working on the idea for a couple of years before that, and that was another reason why I got in financial trouble, is because the money I was making from the TV show, which, as I mentioned, was weaning down, I was funding my invention.
What was it?
The Abdur.
Oh, so your Abdur was your very first invention?
Yes, the Abdur was my very first invention, And, you know, I had to fund the patent and the attorney and a lot of the upstart marketing materials. I had to travel to trade shows to do presentations and things like that. So, you know, I was $10,000, $15,000, maybe $20,000, $25,000 into it, just raw dollars without time factored in, out of my own money. So the Abdur was draining me. But like most inventors, it's like, hey, this is do or die. You know, I believe in this product. I'm going to make this thing work no matter what. And again, with the TV shows declining, sponsorship funds coming in, and I wasn't profiting. I was paying everybody that was working for me, which was only two people at the time, but all the outsources that I had a fulfillment company, a telemarketing company. I was paying all my bills, but I wasn't paying John Abdo, and I became that deeply in debt. But like I mentioned, I made several presentations for the Abdur, and you know, sometimes people don't act like, okay, yeah, we'll take your invention. We'll be the licensee for your product. It didn't happen until 6 months later. I got a call 6 months later. Now, mind you, I sold everything that I owned. I sent 40 boxes of clothes and computer equipment, and I had my little stereo and stuff like that. I sent 40 boxes to the hotel. That was all I had. So there was times when I was obviously packing up to leave, in transit when I left, and then once I got to California to get set up, you know, there's times I wasn't even really that much focusing on my adversarial financial situation. I was just focusing on reestablishing myself. But like I said, I only had enough money, literally, based on what my expenses were at the time, and I got 3 months free rent, but the 3 months thereafter, and my gas expenses, my auto expenses, because I leased a new car, I had 6 months to the day, Michael, and that's 6 months, well, within 5 months, I got a call from a marketing company saying that they were going to take on my product, and 6 months, I got my first royalty check. It was a miracle, and, you know, miracles happen when people expect the miracles to happen. I expected this to happen, even though I was going through selling everything that I owned, changing locations, having to lose my first big baby, and my big baby, the one I loved the most, was my TV show. I loved that show. That was my baby. It brought me around the world. It put me in contact with people in all areas that I was interested in. It was my promotion and it was my dedication, but I lost that. I didn't have the funds to support it anymore, so I had to get rid of it. But when the Abdur hit, it just opened up a whole new world for me, and it was just fantastic.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. So I want to bring you back, and I want you to try and remember the very first germination of you wanting to be an inventor, this idea of the Abdur. Where did it germinate? Where did it start, and how far into your TV show career were you? Tell me where the idea started, and you said in your head, I am going to invent something, and I want a product of my own that I can control and sell. Where did it all start?
When I first had the idea for the Abdur, it was in the midst of financial turmoil with my TV shows. This was like 1994, 1995, and I'm laying in bed thinking, God, I need something. I need to get out of this situation. I need to make money to support my family, and I want to have something that drives me passionately for my career and my professional life. But at that time, I was maybe $70,000 in debt, and it was just like one of those things where I'm laying in a bed just asking, praying, wondering, all this other stuff, and boom. Michael, it just like fell out of the ceiling right into my head, and it hit me so profoundly that I seen it then and I seen the future. I seen everything with this idea. Now, it was me putting all those time periods, past, current, and future, into a tangible presentation. Because at the time, and even more now, I knew that this product would help everybody, not just athletes, but it would also help people who needed to lose body fat.
Explain for the listeners who don't know what an Abdur is, what this idea was, what problem it was going to solve, what market it was going to potentially go to, what was unique about this idea based on all your experience.
When it comes to abdominal training, back then, and even today, aside from John Abdo technology, there's a major flaw in the industry. Everybody was on this crunch craze. It was an abdominal crunch craze. Lay on the floor and lift your chest and head just a few inches off the ground, and you're contracting your upper abdominals. And everyone was doing crunch, 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 crunch. Well, concurrent with my fitness career, I was also working rehabilitation and physical therapy and things like that. And we've seen a rise in back injuries from people, whether they were athletes or non-athletes. And we'd ask them, hey, what kind of training you're doing? Of course, as crunches were part of the training, they were overdeveloping the abdominals. But if you look at the torso from a full circumference, 360-degree perimeter, the spinal column sits in the back. They were ignoring training the mid to lower back. So the spinal vertebrae lacked muscular support of that very vulnerable skeletal region. So by overdeveloping the abdominals, which everyone was focusing on a six-pack, they were underdeveloping their lower backs. And back then, a lot of doctors, professional fitness trainers, even physical therapists said, don't train the back. This is the worst part of your body for injury, which it was. But I was saying, you need to train the back. The reason why people have lower back problems is because they're out of balance or out of condition or too weak. So I invented the Abdur to mobilize all of the muscles surrounding the spinal column from the back, from the sides, which we can call love handles if you have fat obliques on the sides, and certainly the abdomen region. So here's a product that allows your torso to have its complete natural anatomical functionality in every position, forward flexion, backward extension, rotation, twisting, circumduction, which is round circular motions. Just like if you were in a seated position doing a dance or figure skating or shadow boxing, and if you're looking at the skeleton of that person, watching the spinal column and the torso rotate. The Abdur has several patents on there. One of them is a spinal decompression chamber. So as you're moving your torso in all these different positions, you are not compressing the intervertebral disc. The intervertebral disc is like that cartilage in your nose, and if you squeeze your nose right between your nostrils, you'll feel a little piece of cartilage in there, and it's like a guitar pick, and that's exactly the same type of cartilage that is in between each of the 24 vertebrae that goes from the bottom of your skull to the top of your pelvis.
Now, did you see any machines out there that provided the benefits of your Abdur? Was there anything in the gyms?
There was nothing anywhere, Michael, whether it was at professional sports facilities, orthopedic, medical, rehab, clinics, fitness centers, there's nothing. The Abdur was a total original idea. And there's a part of me saying, hey, there's other experts out there in anatomical science and human biomechanics. Why hasn't anybody else had this idea? But that's the beautiful thing about inventions. When you have an idea that's a viable idea, it is really profoundly different and profoundly beneficial. So that's why I pursued it, and it ultimately became the number one product in the world, which took time, obviously, but it was definitely something that I believed in. So the Abdur number one is a feel-good machine. It strengthens the inner core of your body from the spinal column number one, which houses your central nervous system. But it not only works the abs, the Abdur, I tell people, quit thinking about just the abs. Because the Abdur will get your abs, but start thinking about the entire midsection, because people are doing crunches and crunches and crunches and crunches. Me too. I was doing 500 crunches a night, and the front part of my midsection got strong and a little bit leaner, but I still had fatty sides, the love handles, and my lower back. I had a suffering lower back. I actually had a back injury for many, many years. And when it came time to put on my bathing suit or tighten the belt around my pants, I'm thinking, hey, these pants or this belt wraps around my entire midsection, so why am I only working one part of it, which is just like 4 inches to each side of my navel and 4 inches up and down my navel? I need to work the entire midsection, and as a result of that, it's almost like if you took a balloon and if you just pressed one side of the balloon. When you press one side of the balloon where your hand is pressing, that becomes flat, but the other sides protrude out. Now take that same balloon and tie a ribbon around the whole balloon and tighten that ribbon. Now all of a sudden, everything that the ribbon is touching becomes tapered, so now you have that symmetrical V-shaped tapered. And the Abdur is just a beautiful machine as far as now with its bonus effect of having the look-good benefits. After being a feel-good machine, it develops the inner strength and integrity of your body, the skeletal, nervous, and muscular system. But because of its fat-burning and muscle-shaping effects with the system, it body shapes and loses body fat around the entire middle region of the body.
Great. So there's your big idea. I understand your unique selling proposition. I understand your positioning in the marketplace. There was nothing out on the market like this. So you had this idea. What was your first step that you did to pursue on your idea? Now, you got to think, we got a lot of IMPEX people who are inventors, who have ideas. They've got the big idea. And I want to take the listeners through the process of how you pursued it. And let's talk about any of the mistakes and some of the pitfalls and some of the warnings, some things that you personally experienced from the first germination of your idea to a successful product through TV infomercials. So you laid in bed, you had that idea, you had tremendous financial stress. What did you do to act on that idea first? What was your first instinct to do? Get a patent?
You know, there's a multitude of things that you have to think about, because pursuing the maturation or the tangibility of an idea, of an intangible or an unseen, what I had to do is make a list of all the things that I had to do and were necessary to do in order for me to develop and protect and market my idea, which was a vast list. So I definitely kept an inventor's log, which many, many years later helped me win a lawsuit having that inventor's log, because I had things documented in that log that my opponent, who was trying to sue me for a frivolous claim, they were just opportunistic, trying to get me to settle, they could not back up. I mean, they couldn't believe I had this log as detailed as I had it.
Tell the listener why it's important for them, when they have an idea, to document it.
It's important to document everything you do for yourself, number one, because you want to make sure, like, if you're making phone calls or contacting people, it's a good ticker file to say, okay, I called Michael today, I left a message, or I spoke with Michael today and he told me he's going to get this done for me by next Thursday. So in your log, you put next Thursday, expecting a call from Michael. I mean, things like that. So it keeps you in line with that, because if you don't have a secretary or secretaries and assistants and things like that, you're basically a one-man band. So you really need that. Plus, from a legal standpoint, you need to document the development of that intellectual property, because from a legal standpoint, you really need to have the parts of the process documented should you have to go into some type of litigious situation, which I've been in, and fortunately I've been able to win because of the fact that I've had valid documentation. But I pursued developing a prototype. After contemplating the idea in my head, I'm thinking, okay, this is how the human body moves. Now, can I invent a machine that complements that? And it was quite challenging at the beginning, but I went to one of those Builder Square type of places, you know, those big, gigantic places, and I'm over there, and I'm looking for just some PVC pipe. I'm a handy guy, so I know how to get plumbing and constructing materials and things like that. And I remember walking out of there, Michael, with like $4.89 worth of pipe and elbow brackets and things like that. But the funny thing is that when I was in there, the gentleman that was working there in the store, I says, hey, where can I find these elbow brackets? Where can I find PVC pipe and all this other stuff? And the guy was very, very helpful. But after a while, you know, because I needed like about 10 or 12 different parts, which were all glued together, ultimately, he was scratching the back of his head. He goes, wait a minute. This isn't your typical plumbing job. What are you trying to build here, buddy? And I told him, I said, it's an invention. I can't tell you. That was like my first funny story with development of the Abdur.
Before you did that, and you just mentioned you wanted to keep it to yourself, which I think is important for inventors, not to tell everyone about their inventions until it's documented or protected. Did you make any steps to protect or file a patent or call one of those supposed patent companies off TV, anything before you got to the process of building your prototype, or was that your next step?
Oh, yes. There was multiple things occurring concurrent with one another.
Let's talk about some of those, because other inventors who hear this are probably going to be doing the same thing, and I want to give them advice on experiences that were good and bad in that process.
You have to put together drawings, and you don't have to be a great artist. Just start drawing it, and as you're drawing it, you're learning from it, and you have to date it. That's one very important thing. Put dates on there.
Did you have professional help helping you with this?
Not in the beginning stages. No, I was just a solo team. It was just John Abdo and associates, and I was the associate. You know, you put together drawings. I went to the hardware store, and I built a prototype, and even though it was a funky, what we call the duct tape glued together prototype, it actually was like, wow, this thing's going to work. So I was documenting things like that. I was looking through directories, went to the library. The internet wasn't big at the time.
What were you looking for in directories?
Oh, patent attorneys, you know, marketing companies. I was familiar with TV because I was involved with TV with so many years, 10 years at that time. But these weren't infomercial companies, but they were companies that did advertise on TV. But I used to go to all the sporting goods shows, and the sporting goods shows would have companies that did the TV advertising.
Did you proceed to get a patent on your intellectual idea?
No. What I advise inventors is not to get a patent on their idea at the beginning.
Why?
Because if you apply for a patent and the product isn't even developed, once that patent is released, now all of a sudden by the time that you file that patent, especially in my duct tape stages, by the time I actually was ready myself to file for a patent, which was about a year and a half later, the product had changed so much. So you really need to have your ducks in a row to file for the patent. The best thing to do is to file for a provisional patent application.
What is a provisional patent application?
A provisional patent application is a broad understanding of the spirit of the idea or the invention. And from there, you could add on different descriptive elements, and the provisional patent application secures your idea for 1 year, so the clock starts ticking once you file the PPA. And once that provisional patent application is filed, now I could bring it to anybody. I could bring it to ABC Marketing Corporation and say, sign this non-disclosure agreement. I have a patent pending on this particular product. Now you can legally and hopefully securely disclose your idea to another company with the fact that this is just a rough prototype. This is the spirit of the idea, but it's certainly not market ready. So there's a lot of changes that can be made to make it look better, but certainly function better, maybe even ship better and assemble better and cost less and things like that. So to come up with a patent right away, unless you fully know everything about that product, is not the best way to go, and it's also the expensive way.
Who helped you with the provisional patent?
I had an attorney do that.
Okay, so how did you find your attorney?
Through a phone directory. Here's how I selected my attorney. I called people up through a directory, and I bought books on inventing and things like that. You know, I just found different books at the library and bookstore and stuff. I called people up, and Michael, the one who had the patience to listen to what I had to say, was the one I felt the most comfortable with. Other ones, yeah, right, okay, just come on in, I charge $400 an hour, blah, blah, blah. The people who were fast and patient, didn't give a hoot on who I was, or, hey, I've heard this story 1,000 times before because I told them, hey, I got this great idea, and I'm John Abdo, and I got my own TV show, and I got a big audience already, and I know fitness and all this stuff. I needed to work with somebody I felt comfortable with because I needed to talk about my product. And when you have intellectual property, one of the things the attorney tells you is, who would you tell? And if you say, I told my girlfriend or I told my father, they go, oh, it's public domain. You can't do that. It's not patentable anymore. I mean, some patent attorneys will tell you that. And I want to throw in another disclaimer here. I'm not a patent attorney. And what I'm telling your listeners right now are telling you, it's different for other inventors and what other invention counselors and or patent attorneys would advise, but this is the route that I went and ultimately was the right and safe route. However, securing the patent for myself, which I ultimately obtained in 1999, then my second patent was issued in 2001, doesn't prevent you from getting knocked off. I had over 33 people infringing on my patents, and certainly doesn't prevent you from going into a lawsuit. It just gives you offensive rights to protect yourself, so I just want people to be aware of that.
That's right. Okay, so you hired this attorney, you did your provisional patent. Did he have to do a patent search? And can you describe what that is to the listener?
Yeah, and that was really enlightening because all of a sudden he goes, John, I've done so many patent searches for inventors before who come to me saying, oh, okay, I got this original idea, I've never seen anything like this before. But Michael, if you've ever gone and done a patent search, and at the time I went to the Chicago Library because I was living in Illinois, and we do a patent search, it's got that microfilm. There's millions and millions of bits of information.
What's the purpose of a patent search?
To see if somebody else has got a product out there similar or exact, or that your product infringes on that, because you could spend all the time, money, and effort to develop, to build, to capitalize the product, to pay for patents and trademarks and all that other stuff, and then as soon as you release it, all of a sudden you get a letter in the mail, dear Mr. So-and-so, you're infringing on my product. I have the same patent, or I have something that you're infringing upon. You don't know that. I mean, everything is secret until it becomes public domain or it's released. So you're just really keeping your fingers crossed, and a good patent attorney can do a great search, but they'll always tell you, this is their waiver and their disclaimer, we can't search everything that's out there, because my product fell into fitness category, fell into sports category, fell into medical category, physical therapy category, and there's no way they could search that. But the good thing is that when they did come back with a search, I believe they came back with like 20 or 25 products that when they came up with a search, these were items that the search came up as similar. You look at them, and I go, none of these are similar. None of these even come close. And then you ask your patent attorney, you know, am I infringing on anybody? He says, no, but they do come up. It's what they call other arts or other inventions that are currently in the marketplace that would be within the category or close proximity of similarity to what you're inventing.
For the listeners, we're doing a patent search because we want to make sure that our idea is novel and original. So give the listeners the best John Abdo definition based on from your understanding what a patent is and why would someone even want one and what criteria do you need to be awarded a patent by the U.S. government?
The broad term that I use in layman's terms as an inventor, and obviously there's professional definitions to this, a patent is the grant of ownership to that idea, which allows you to have that ownership for a specific period of time, which is usually about 17 to 20 years, depending on when the patent is released. So now you own that patent. You own that idea, and nobody can produce something similar or exact. And you could obviously go after them for cease and desist or for royalties or suing them for blatant infringement or blocking them from coming into the marketplace, into stores, or putting it on TV. So the patent is your way of protecting your idea. The law here in the United States is not the first to file for a patent. And this is a real touchy area. And there's some patent holders and inventors that say, don't ever file a patent. You don't need to file a patent. And there's some truth to that. But again, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not giving the advice. I'm just giving a scenario. That if you could prove that you were the first to invent this, which is by a log, show documentation and, you know, on computers that have date created, date modified, and all the documents and things like that. Somebody could come up with an invention. You could say, hey, you're infringing on my invention. They go, hey, well, we did an examination and your product never came up in the patent search. You go, hey, I never filed for a patent, but this is my idea that I've kept to myself and my date predates your date, so I was the first to invent. According to some patent attorneys, legally, you have the rights to that idea.
Even if you didn't file for a patent with your idea?
If you didn't file for a patent. I recently listened to an interview that I had listened to a long time ago. I go, let me listen to this guy again. He suggests to inventors not to file for a patent. Now, let me explain this, Michael. When I went to marketing companies to market my product, they have to invest millions of dollars, literally, in inventory, in the infomercial, which infomercials today cost on the low side $200,000, on the high side $600,000. Some infomercials that you're seeing on TV are costing $1 million. That's just for a 30-minute infomercial. It has nothing to do with the instructional DVDs, the user group, the university tests. I mean, there's literally $1 to $2 million invested in the project. They want to make sure that the project that they are investing in, your idea, your invention, is patented. So in the event that somebody comes after them later on, like, hey, you're selling my product on TV through your infomercial, that they have legal rights to stand their ground, you know, and to obviously protect their investment and their property. So you, as the inventor, are the licensor of that technology to the licensee, which is the marketing company, who most likely, in every situation I've been in, demands a unique, original, and patented idea in order for them to risk the high-risk investment of that particular project.
John, what kind of patent did you have? A utility patent or a design patent? And can you explain if you know the difference? You're listening to Michael Senoff interview John Abdo on HardToFindSeminars.com. This is the end of part one. Please continue to part two.